The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello, and welcome to Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by the author and critic Arianne Banks, whose new book is called The Quality of Love, Twin Sisters at the Heart of the Century. Welcome, Arianne. Now, this is one of those books that begins with a tin chest full of letters, but unusually for such family memoirs, it's not a chest full of letters about someone who discovered that their grandmother, you know, either ran away from the Nazis or was a Nazi. It's a much deeper and richer and more complicated story than that. And it tells the story of the Paget twins. Who are the Paget twins, Ariadne?
So the Paget twins were my mother and aunt, identical twin sisters born in 1916. They were orphaned by the age of 12 because their mother died from complications at their birth. And their very beloved father died when they were 12. Casting them, as it were, into outer darkness. They grew up in a simple rural childhood in Suffolk with almost no friends. They didn't go to school. They weren't sent to school, actually. From the age of 7, a retired village schoolmaster walked up the lane and gave them 1 hour of lessons a day. My mother said she learnt more from the village schoolmaster in that 1 hour than she ever learnt at any of the schools she subsequently was sent to. But they didn't go to school. They didn't have many local friends. They had very few relatives. But when their father died, they were taken in by a very wealthy uncle and aunt who lived in enormous grandeur in a vast house in Roehampton called Ibstock Place, which is now actually an independent school. And there were their uncle and aunt and the two daughters, Winnie and Anne, who were 3 years older and younger than the twins respectively. They were astonished to arrive in this house, which had 18 servants in it, including a butler whose head apparently was higher on one side than the other, and hordes of maids and housekeepers and cooks, governesses,
etc. So it sounds like they were what we'd now identify as posh girls.
Well, their cousins were very posh. I mean, they were really sort of English gentry. They were completely nonplussed by this new life of theirs. And the one thing they really wanted to do, which was to go to a decent school that taught them something, didn't happen because their uncle and aunt really didn't believe that girls should have much education, because the only thing...
They were obviously intelligent, though, weren't they? I mean, unschooled, but you know, the story that you go on to tell is one that takes them right to the heart of the intellectual world of the early and mid-20th
century. It did. I mean, they were incredibly bright, both of them, and actually very musical as well, passionate about books, passionate about music. And this is why they found it very frustrating not to be sent to decent schools. In fact, when they were 15, they were sent off to a finishing school in Switzerland where they, you know, didn't learn a great deal, but they made so many friends, European, Italian, French, American, that it really sort of grounded them in a sort of cosmopolitan world which they drew on for the rest of their lives.
So what's your sense of their characters? Because obviously, you know, they start out from a position as almost Dickensian kind of trauma, and yet they seem to have been extraordinarily kind of vivacious.
They were naturally incredibly vivacious and very, very positive in their outlook. I say that I never knew my aunt because she died the year before I was born, very sadly. But she was identical to my mother. My mother was a very positive person with a
wonderful
sense of
humour. Your mother was Celia,
which
is how your aunt was called, my man.
That's right, yes. They both had a wonderful sense of humour. They had a great wit. They were very droll. And they were passionately intelligent. I mean, my mother was one of the most highbrow people I've ever met in my entire life. And I think as they grew up, the main was probably the more brittle of the two. I get that impression from their correspondence and from what people said about them. But they were intensely close. I mean, they were each other's kindred spirits and they shared everything. They hardly sort of needed, when they communicated with one another, they just took so much for granted that they would have the same reactions, the same, they'd find the same things amusing, they'd find the same things interesting, they would find the same people attractive. And they were identical in both looks, really, and temperament, I would say.
In this tin trunk which starts your new journey, you get their letters, the correspondence between them. They were moving around the world. They were writing to each other absolutely constantly. Were these things that you knew as you were growing up, or was this a kind of revelation to you, like, oh, my God, you know, because Mamane, I should say, she died shortly before you were born, so you never knew her, as you mentioned. And yet this was a sort of absolutely central part of the almost of your mother's life. Was it present to you growing up, or is this something comes a revelation?
Yes, very much so. I mean, because Mamane had been so vital to my mother, obviously, as I grew up, my mother talked about her more and more. And we became very close as well to Mamane's former husband, Arthur Kersler, who, when after Mamane's death, which he was devastated by, he absolutely adored my mother. I mean, apart from anything else, my mother reminded him of Mamane, whom he had lost. And they were very close. They were as close, I think, as any brother and sister-in-law could have been. And Arthur, in fact, bought a house in Suffolk near us in Cambridge, and we saw an enormous amount of them. And, of course, Arthur and my mother would endlessly talk about the world in which they had both lived, the friends they'd had, the ideas they discussed. I mean, Mamane was an ever-present feature as I was growing up in my life. But of course, when I discovered I knew the tin trunk existed. It wasn't until after my mother's death that I went through it in great detail and translated all the letters from Camus to Mamane, for instance, which took some time because his handwriting wasn't that legible. And my French wasn't that good. But, you know, it wasn't until then that I really charted the narrative of their lives and put everything. I managed to work out what happened when, the dates in which they travelled hither and thither. You know, when your mother talks to you, you don't really focus on the details necessarily. So I was able to do that through all the correspondences that I found in that trunk.
When you talk to your mother about this stuff, I mean, maybe this didn't come up, but you know, you're a writer, she's got an amazing story. Did she ever indicate that she wanted her story to be told, or that she would have thought about writing it herself? I mean, do you have a sense of whether she'd be pleased to see this or kind of in her way mortified?
No, she would have been absolutely thrilled. Many people asked my mother to write her memoirs, but she declined, I think, out of a sense of discretion. But she very much said to me, I'm leaving you everything, darling. It's up to you to do what you will with it. But I know that she knew that I would make something of it and that I would write about it in due course. Although it has taken me a great deal of time. She died in 2002. And really, I've been thinking about it and distilling it, I suppose, in my mind ever since. And also trying to find a structure for it. Because when you're charting two parallel lives, both of them intensely rich and packed with incident, you have to be very selective in order to create a sort of narrative arc that the reader can follow.
Well, let's go into that narrative arc a bit, because your subtitle seems to be suggestive, and part of the recuperative project of the book is, say, they're twin sisters at the heart of the century, that, you know, in some sense, they're sort of Zelig-like figures because they go through meeting and generally being courted by practically every early 20th century intellectual with a pair of trousers one's heard of. What propelled them on this thing? Because they started out in rather conventional style. You know, they were debutantes, weren't they? They were extremely beautiful. They were twins, which obviously the papers love. And they hated that.
They hated it. They hated it. They thought it was a completely fatuous way of spending their time. And unfortunately for them, because they were so beautiful and striking and identical, they were debutantes of the year. But, of course, they failed to get engaged because they were determined not to get engaged to any of the men they met on the circuit. So they had to do it twice, not once, but twice. Anyway, when they were 21, they inherited a small legacy that their father had left for them. And they simply upped and offed and went and bought a small house in Chelsea together. Meanwhile, Mamane was being courted by a very remarkable man called Dick Wyndham, who was an extremely He was really an arch bohemian. He was wealthy enough to be so. He had inherited the estate of Clouds in Wiltshire, but he'd sold it, and he'd bought a very beautiful mill house in Sussex, where he invited all his friends, who were the sort of epicentre of the intellectual world of London at that time. So Cyril Connolly and Peter Quesnel, the painter Matthew Smith, the composer Constant Lambert, the poet Stephen Spender. I mean, he knew everybody, Dick, and he was wildly generous and entertained all his friends and introduced the twins to this world, and they never looked back. At last, they met intelligent, bright, witty, amusing, fascinating people, and they simply never looked back. And they themselves were bright and witty enough to thrive in this world. They found their element.
And my main, whose, you know, romantic career is kind of almost the most, I mean, it's hard to weigh them up, but seems almost the most remarkable, but she's suddenly in a kind of love triangle with, you know, she's passionately attached to Dick Windham, Edmund Wilson, the great American critic. I mean, we should say almost all of these characters, I don't think Dick is married at this point, but, you know, most of them are married and seeking a mistress. Edmund Wilson gets nowhere but writes these incredible puppy dog letters, and then Arthur Koestler shows up.
Yes, it wasn't exactly a triangle because she was with Dick from about 1936, and she didn't actually meet Arthur until 1944, the early 1944. But meanwhile, she had other admirers, as you can imagine. Arthur, of course, was, I mean, Dick had been a pretty high-octane character, but Arthur, I found a wonderful description, which actually I found too late to put in the book. She described him as being like 50 characters from Dostoevsky all rolled into one.
And you think of other authors that might be more complimentary about.
I mean, she was obviously completely captivating, and all these men simply fell for her. I can say no more than that.
Yes. And Koestler is the great, well, I mean, the bulk of my main story is her relationship with Koestler, isn't it? And I have to say, he doesn't sound like a really attractive suitor, or certainly not an attractive kind of common law husband.
Well, he was so complicated, Arthur, but he had enormous depth. He was absolutely passionate about the causes that he was passionate about. She really respected him as a thinker and a writer. She found him very attractive as a man. He was actually very attractive as a man. But more than that, she really revered him and felt that he was right about everything. He was right in his passionate convictions against communism and his great integrity, his intellectual integrity. So although they had a pretty, you know, volatile relationship, I mean, they lived together for 6 years. They married in 1950, and actually she left him in September 1951. They had a very volatile time, but she never, ever lost her faith in him as a writer and a thinker and a man of integrity.
What's extraordinary is a kind of contrast often, I feel like, because my man has this life that roams over the continent and to America and Palestine and all that, and yet kind of home base for much of those 6 years is this kind of extraordinarily kind of dark, dim, dingy, wet, clammy, often frozen farm in Wales where she's, you know, she eats kind of tin pilchards and God knows what and just spends 12 hours a day taking dictation from Koestler, who then gets pissed and starts a fight.
Yes, but as I say, she had an extraordinarily positive nature. As I mean, some of the book is very funny. She was very droll about their life there. They had a lot of local friends. They had sort of wild parties, not as wild as the parties they had in Paris, but nevertheless, they had a lot.
Yes, I was going to say, we'll get onto that.
We'll get onto that. But they had a lot of fun. And, you know, she took the rough with the smooth. She was philosophical enough to take the long view. And as I say, she was of naturally positive temperament. So quite often there'll be a letter, mainly to my mother, in which she will let off a great deal of steam about Koestler, about the weather, about whatever it happened to be. But then she'll say, but, you know, we had a wonderful walk the other day. I saw some willow warblers, saw some curlews, and spring is coming and it's all going to be fine. She was just luckily a very positive person. She wouldn't have survived otherwise.
Can I say parenthetically, one of the big charges against Koestler is that he was a rapist. He raped Jill Craigie, Michael Foot's wife. Unless I turned over two pages at once, you don't mention that in this. Is that something that you thought that's not part of this story?
Well, it's certainly not part of his story in that if he did, it was supposed to have happened in 1959, which is after Mermaine's death and after the book is over. Yeah. What I will say about that is nobody can know what went on between Arthur and Jill Craigie, but they remained very close friends to the end of his life. She and Michael Foot and Arthur and Cynthia would have regular dinners together. And in the photograph of Arthur's 70th birthday party, which is in Michael Scammell's biography of Arthur, she is shown standing next to him in the group of friends he had to that dinner. So she obviously bore him no rancour whatsoever while he was alive. And she only made that remark in 1996 when she was elderly. That's all I will say.
Well, that's fair enough. Now, Celia, meanwhile, her story, she kind of, as it were, bagged the other great anti-communist of the era, George Orwell, who appears in this as Donkey George. And it's also fascinating to me, you get Orwell the single dad.
Yes. Well, that was, I think, part of his attraction for my mother. I mean, my mother absolutely adored small children and that longed to have a family herself, didn't have one at that point in her life. And when they first met, Orwell was struggling with the almost two-year-old Richard. They went down to stay with Arthur and Mermaine for Christmas 1945. And they travelled down on the train together. She simply took to Richard and they played together all the way down on the train. And Orwell was very touched by the way that my mother genuinely loved Richard. And he was very struck by her, smitten by her, as many people were.
He seems to have been unexpectedly himself. It made me think of J.G. Ballard, a sort of writer you wouldn't have thought temperamentally would be this sort of doting father and naturally good with children. But he obviously was, wasn't he?
He was. She said he was for the manner born. I mean, she couldn't get over how natural he was with Richard, how he seemed to know intuitively how to deal with him in every way. And Richard absolutely adored him and would scream for 3 hours if all went out. My mother used to sort of babysit in Canterbury Square and quite often, Richard would be very difficult until he was absolutely convinced that there was no point being difficult any longer, and then he would subside. She was very attracted to Orwell as a man, but she was not attracted to him as a potential husband. Put it simply, she didn't fancy him. He was 17 years older than her. By that stage, he was extremely gaunt. He was ill, not as ill as he later became, obviously, but he was not a well man. And he was very stuck in his ways, she said. So she was deeply attracted to him as a person, and they remained friends to the very end of his life. But she didn't want to marry him.
There's a lovely quote, and I can't remember which sister it is who writes the other one, consoling rather later in life, saying, it's an absolute dog's life when people are desperate to marry one.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful quote. It's Mermaine actually writing to Celia. That's right.
And they got a lot of that, didn't they? I mean, I see Barbara Cartland, who claimed to have all these proposals and she turned them down. But there's that kind of extraordinary quality that almost everybody they meet goes, oh, God, let's get married.
I know, wasn't it extraordinary? But they fobbed a lot of them off.
How do you think they... But how did they do such a good job? Because they both seem to have had this gift. I mean, certainly my main managed it with Edmund Wilson, to take someone who's an ardent would-be lover and find a way of transforming him into a friend.
Well, simply because I think they like these people enormously. They wish to be their friends. They simply managed to deflect those romantic longings into something that turned in Orwell's case, in Edmund's case. I mean, there are many others that I have left on the cutting room floor, I can tell you, into very rich and rewarding friendships. And of course, they were great correspondents. Everybody was in those days. I mean, there were thousands of letters between Mermaine and Edmund Wilson, I can tell you, over the many years that they corresponded. Yes, they were great letter writers, both of them.
And some of these letters do also, you know, you get this sort of glimpse of these titans, the intellect of the 20th century, as very fallible and ordinary people. You know, I read like one of, I think it's an Orwell love letter to Celia, where he says, you know, some great attachment of the heart and so forth. But also, you know, I fell for you physically when I saw you walking up the stairs in front of me.
Yes. Well, they were, you know, they were intellectual giants, but they were just perfectly ordinary men who either were or were not. So husband material.
Yes, no, not husband material. And that brings us on to the, I mean, you mentioned just earlier, proleptically, when Mamène goes to Paris first, there are these absolutely kind of, it's almost comical, these sort of howlingly drunk knights on the tiles, which end up in the sort of eating lobster thermidor and liver and onions at 5 a.m. and go from nightclub to nightclub. But the crowd is Koestler and Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, who they've got some terribly disrespectful nickname for. What do they call her?
The Castor.
The Castor.
Yes. Which was the French word for beaver.
Oh, yes. And, of course, that would explain. And of course, Albert and Francine Camus. I mean, one of those nights ends up in a sort of, I mean, it's almost kind of slightly student-y, isn't it? The Koestler kind of passes out and suddenly the semi-sober Mamène and Camus find themselves together.
Yes, that's right. They do. And then, well, on their way back, when she finally drags the drunken Koestler back towards home, she relates how on the journey he stood outside a pissoir while Arthur from within yelled, "Don't leave me. I love you. I'll always love you," into the night sky. They were complete benders. And of course, they all drank vast amounts and got wildly drunk and very out of order. But, you know, this is this wonderful stories that I read in the letters.
And yet there's this moment, what follows from that is Mamène, who's generally pretty faithful to Koestler, much more so than he is to her. But she and Camus have this, is it a week? Not much more than that, is it?
It was an absolute coup de foudre. They completely fell for one another. She didn't want to fall for Camus. She wanted to remain faithful to Koestler. She felt, on the other hand, that, as she put it, one only gets one chance like this in one's life. And she succumbed, and they went off to spend a week in Provence together, where they were literally not apart for a sort of second of the day. And they wandered around the Luberon Valley, which is where Camus subsequently bought a house, actually, in the village of Lomarin. They discovered the village together. They had a week of complete and utter passion and bliss. But they knew it couldn't last. Camus was married with young twin children, and his wife, Francine, was actually quite emotionally fragile, and he knew that he could never leave her. And, of course, Mamène really realised, or felt she realised, that her future was with Arthur too. So they parted. They tried desperately not to see one another for a couple of years. But again, and they managed, but again, that great passion segued into a really intense and close friendship.
There's the most moving bit, I think, after Mamène's death, that Camus writes to Celia, doesn't he, and quotes his Hölderlin line.
Yes. Oh, yes, one single summer, all powerful ones, grant me one single summer.
It's just the strength of feeling in that, particularly, you know, you don't really expect from the man who wrote L'Étranger, you know.
No. Oh, he was deeply moved by Mamène's death. And thereafter, he sort of transferred a lot of his affection, as it were, to Celia, until his own death, of course, his sudden death in 1960.
Celia, meanwhile, which are sort of to jump tracks again. I'm sorry, we're going back and forth and across the channel a little bit, as your book does before. Who were Celia's great loves?
Well, I think the greatest love of her life, I think, before she met my father, was Jeremy Hutchinson, who became this marvellously...
This is barrister.
The barrister, yeah. Marvellous man, really marvellous man. And they had a very passionate affair, but he was also married. He was very lonely in his marriage to Peggy Ashcroft, because being an actress, she was out almost every evening and even at weekends rehearsing and acting on the stage. And in fact, it was Jeremy's mother who realised that he was so lonely within his marriage and orchestrated his meeting with my mother. And they had a very, very passionate affair. But because he was married, it couldn't last. So before my father, really, he was the greatest love of her life. She was deeply, deeply fond of Orwell, and there were other men too, who I don't even mention in the book.
Huh. Freddie Ayo gets a mention.
Oh, yes.
Well, the giant 20th century philosopher.
Freddie Ayo, yeah, sorry, I forgot about Freddie Ayo.
Not marriage material either.
But definitely not marriage material. But again, there's a photo in the book of him swinging me on my swing when I was 3 years old, because again, that relationship segued into a friendship, which lasted all my mother's life. She
you
was...
must be one of the few people also who, living or dead who owned a teddy bear donated by Albert Camus.
Yes, well...
Oh, that's fantastic detail. That's celebrity teddy bear.
I wish I still had it.
And, of course, Bob Conquest, the great anti-communist, he, in his younger career, was writing your mother love letters, and she wasn't having any of it.
Well, they were sharing an office.
Not poems, sorry.
Yes, poems. They were sharing an office at the Information Research Department, which was this fascinating offshoot of the Foreign Office, which was devoted to countering Soviet propaganda. And she worked there for several years and literally shared an office with Bob Conquest, who was a very, very fascinating man himself, and went on to write The Great Terror much later. Yes, he was an admirer, but not marriage material either.
And actually, it's while she was working in that office that she hooks into one of the great scandals of Orwell's posterity, at least, which is the famous list, the denunciations, as they were oppositionally characterised. That was, if I'm reading your account of it right, much more of a storm in a teacup than...
It was a complete storm in a teacup in that the only reason that she went to see Orwell to ask him to give the list was to find out if there were people whom he suspected might be sympathetic to the Soviet cause, because her job, or the job of the department, was to commission anti-Soviet articles and to disseminate them throughout Europe and indeed the Middle East and the rest of the world. And it would have been rather stupid if they had commissioned people who had covert Soviet sympathies or communist sympathies. And there were several of them lurking. In fact, Guy Burgess actually worked for a while in the same department as my mother. And obviously, he was going to turn out to be a communist spy. So they were very alert to the fact that there might be other potential traitors lurking in the woodwork. And that is one of the reasons that she asked Orwell for this list. And really, it was a very mild document. He was querying certain names. He was not particularly rude about anybody but Peter Smollett, whom he designated a very slimy person. And he turned out indeed to be a Soviet spy. But the worst that would happen to them...
Soviet spy got an OBE, I think you
yes,
say.
Yes, he was given an OBE. And the worst that would happen to these people would be that they would not be commissioned by the IRD to write anti-Soviet articles. So the whole thing was a massive storm in a teacup, really. And as my mother said very robustly when challenged, it wasn't as if they were going to be shot at dawn. She was very indignant about the fuss that erupted.
It's curious, she has this, you know, huge life before she meets and marries your father. Your father, Arthur Goodman, is someone who pursued her, as did everyone else, at one point in, I think, the 40s. And she said, no, I'm not going to marry you. What, as it were, changed her mind?
Well, the time that he first proposed, she was in love with Fred Eyre. Then he went off and married somebody else. He went to live in Japan. He only returned in 1953. I mean, a lot of water had passed under the bridge between then. And my mother had been with Jeremy Hutchinson in the meantime, but that was impossible because he was married. So she found herself single. She re-met my father, whom she had been very fond of, very devoted to, actually. And the stars aligned. It was simply that. But she was so worried that he wouldn't propose to her again for fear of rebuff a second time that she actually proposed to him. And he rather charmingly said, goodness, Celia, well, I think I should probably love to.
Do you ever get a sense of whether your father felt jealous of your mother's previous attachments?
He certainly felt jealous of Jeremy. And for about 8 years in our childhood, we never saw Jeremy. But later on, after my father's death, he came back into our lives. And again, a very, very close friendship, not only with my mother, but with me. He was almost, I felt as if he was my godfather, really. And I knew him very well until his own death. Yeah, so he must have felt slightly jealous, I think.
No, it certainly sounds like that way. And the other great jealousy on the other side of the tracks is that Dick Windham and Arthur Kersley, I mean, Dick died relatively early in the story, but they were kind of really not at all temperamentally affectionate in the way that Kersler obviously loved Camus, even though they were somewhat he respected Camus, but Dick Windermann, as you say, when they go to Palestine in order to look at what was going on there, I think Koestler's, you know, sort of passionate Zionist, and Dick Windham's embedded with the Arab forces, isn't he?
Completely embedded with the Arab forces. No, they were completely chalk and cheese, and there was a huge rivalry between them. They met quite often, actually, during their travels, but they never got on, and they were wildly jealous about Mamane, because Dick never really got over his affair with Mamane. He never found another partner. And yes, there was no love lost between them.
Yeah. I should ask, given that they were identical twins, they moved in these same social circles, did they ever find themselves, as it were, being pursued by the same men?
Well, funnily enough, my father first met Mamane and took rather a shine to her. So, but on the whole, not really. It's strange, isn't it? As I say, I think that Mamane was a more brittle and febrile person than my mother. You know, they were not completely identical in character. And there never seemed to be any problem in that respect between them, any rivalries in love.
It's your sense of Mamane also, I mean, her asthma, which both sisters suffered from, kind of carried her off young. But her deal with Koestler was they would live together as if they were married, but they won't have children. How much did that bug her?
It really, well, she settled for it, but very, very reluctantly. And one of the reasons that she left him when she did was because finally her desire to have children, to have a family life, I think, combined with his manifold difficulties, really made her realise that before it was too late, she would go off and drown.
Yeah, so the actual wedding night is a sort of catastrophe, isn't it?
It's a catastrophe. Absolutely. They went out on a, you know, on a bender, as it were. Arthur got so drunk that she refused to let him drive her home. So he drove off into the night, and she went back with Stephen Spender to his flat and spent the night chastely on the sofa with Stephen, who then commented ruefully the following morning, "I've always wanted to spend the night with you, Mamane. It's just too much of a shame it had to be your married night."
There's a distinction that I think Celia makes when George Orwell's about to marry a Sonia. She makes a distinction between someone who's a person of feelings and an intellectual. Where do you place the sisters on that scale? Because so much of this story is about their feelings, and yet the world in which they lived was so intellectual.
Yes, and they were also, I mean, I would say that my mother was vastly more intellectual than Sonia, actually. My mother was a genuine, I suppose you'd call her a blue stocking, passionately, passionately interested in ideas and literature. I mean, they were deeply feeling people, but they were very, very bright, the twins. They never had a decent education, but they were self-educated. They were autodidacts. They read widely and voraciously and were extremely grounded in both literary and musical culture, and they could hold their own with anybody. And that is why they thrived in these circles. I mean, they were really, I won't say they were necessarily the equal of those men, but they were not far behind.
And there is a sort of most poignant thing. When Mamane died, your mother didn't go to her funeral.
No. The twins had made a pact with one another that neither would go to the other's funeral. They just knew they wouldn't be able to bear it. And also my mother, well, they were both intrinsically unconventional. They really were. So they didn't see anything wrong with not turning up at each other's funerals. It didn't matter to them what other people would have thought of that. They just knew they couldn't bear it, so they didn't do it.
And you say as you're growing up, in some ways, you said you took the place of Mamane.
Well, I didn't want to. I mean, I think it was such a huge hole in her life that very, very gradually, as I was growing up, I think she felt we had a great deal in common, she and I. We talked the same language, we enjoyed the same things. And I think that I began to replace Mamane unconsciously. In her mind, she actually said that she would sometimes confuse us even in her dreams. But she therefore sort of assumed that I would be more like Mamane than I wanted to be, because I wanted to be me. I wanted to be Ariane independently. So I found myself in my teenage years rather rebelling against that, and sort of doing things that I would normally not have done, but just in order to establish my own identity. However, it all smoothed out by my 20s, and we were very close as mother and daughter indeed. And I think part of writing this book for me is really discovering this aunt that I never knew, sadly, but who was obviously a marvellous person and who I would have been very close to had she lived. I mean, close to in temperament, I think, and close to in, well, in interests and everything else.
Well, you bring her wonderfully to life in this. Quality of Love's out now. Erin Banks, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.